stuff. Your name is?
My name is Ben Gaines. In Stanford, Kentucky. I was born in Lincoln County, Kentucky, June the 7th, 1914. The purpose of this is to try to narrate to my children and grandchildren the changes in lifestyle and way of living that have occurred in my time. When I was born, the doctor came to the house and stayed till the baby was delivered. I was told that we had an old black watchdog. It was a very good dog. And he saw the neighbor ladies come in and find the doctor come in. And he decided there's enough traffic in, so he laid down across the door and wouldn't let anybody in or out till he heard the baby, heard me cry, the baby cry. And then he got whistled up real good. My brother Morris came along 16 months later. Our parents were Robert Gaines, who was a 50-year-old widower, and our mother was a 38-year-old teacher. We were the only two children. We lived in a brick house. It was built near the Whitley House here in Lincoln County. Remember the living room, the hall, and the other room across the hall were all paneled with black walnut. We had nice fireplaces. It was two-story. We had a kitchen on the back that did the cooking, a dining room, and a full basement. And the attic was in had a nice wood floor, and we stored flour and meal and things like that up there. But when we were born, we had no electricity. We used coal oil lamps. There was no radio, no TV, no refrigerator, no electric stove, no running water. We carried water from the spring some hundred yards away from the house. And little country boys were never without chores. And if we weren't carrying water, we were carrying in coal, wood, kindling, gathering eggs, and frequently we had pet pigs and pet lambs to take care of, as well as chores in the garden. We were a self-sufficient family. We raised practically everything we ate. And the old house was always comfortable. We slept upstairs with no heat and never seemed to feel any discomfort. We had plenty of blankets and a feather bed to sleep on. Later on, Father got real affluent. We had a Delco light plant, which was a series of batteries and a kerosene-operated engine that made a peculiar put. And it was hard to start. We had to put ether in it to start it. We had one light in each room. I don't think there was a plant receptacle in the house. And it may have been one. And we, for refrigeration, we had a nice spring, a spring house. And we put milk in crocks and set them at the edge of the water where the water circulated around them. And we always had good cool milk and butter. We had plenty of eggs because we had chickens. And chickens in the cream can were important thing to every housewife in those days, because you could take those eggs to town on Saturday and get some money. The same way with the cream you had left over. We had our own meat. We killed hogs and cured the hams, bacon, the shoulders. We made lard. We even saved the grease from the lard, from the fat from the kitchen, and made homemade lye soap, which we used. We stored apples and potatoes in the basement and kept them till May each year. We had a good garden. We raised peaches, apples, strawberries, cherries, gooseberries, and about any kind of fruit that was hardy and grew there. And there's very little of it wasted, because what we couldn't save, it was canned or preserved in some way. When we sold quite a few peaches and occasionally a few apples. Let's cut off now.
Okay.
Hope to get our good covered, brother.
We walked approximately a mile to a one-room school that sat on top of a bald hill. There were maybe 20 children in school. And I remember the first 2 years, we had a water bucket and a dipper. And the bigger boys got to go get a bucket of water every so often. There were no sanitary cups. Everybody drank out of the same dipper. And I don't recall having any colds or complications. We all probably had a few fleas, and some of us had some lice. And occasionally we had itch. But as far as the sanitation part, a couple of years later we got a new teacher. They didn't think that was the right thing to do, so everybody had to have a cup. And then the childhood diseases began to come out. We had an old coal stove to keep warm by in the winter. And those that were close to it got too warm, and those back in the corner didn't get warm enough. Of course, we had two outhouses. And it was always the big thing when the county school superintendent would come to visit. He'd bring two boxes of chalk and eraser and about a half dozen rolls of toilet paper, and that's the last time you saw him for that year. And
how many kids were there in the school?
About 20. And a lot of the older boys that had to work. The only time they could go to school was when there was no work on the farm, and they'd go to school for a while. Okay. I remember the first day that I went to school, I sat with a man named Sprinkles, who looked to be about 20 years old, but he was about the fifth grade level in education, because the poor boy just didn't have an opportunity to go to school. Mm-hmm. And staying with his school thing, when we were in the fifth or sixth grade, we had to go to crab orchard for a mother to help take care of her parents. So we went to the school in crab orchard. And it began to be apparent then that we hadn't had the proper basics in spelling and reading and writing and arithmetic that they had had in crab orchard. So in our freshman and sophomore year, we came to Stanford to school, and you can see a difference there. And that same difference is still apparent in our school systems here in the county. I don't think we're getting enough emphasis on the basics, communication, math, and foreign languages. And I went to the University of Kentucky for approximately 2 years, and in the classes that did not require a lot of English, a lot of math, I made A's. In English, I had to have remedial English before I could even qualify for a grade. In the math classes, I had to have remedial math things. And I think that condition may still exist today. We're not putting the right emphasis on the right things for kids to live in the technology we're coming into today. Now, getting back to change in technology, as I said before, when I was born, we had a kerosene lamp, we had no running water, we had no electricity. We didn't know we even needed them. Our first thing I remember was the Delco light plant I told you about. Mm-hmm. And then later on, Dad bought a radio. He had to sell two mules to get it. It came in a nice little wooden cabinet set on a table It had three batteries and two headphones. And quite a thing for the neighbors to come in, because the only one in the neighborhood. You can undo one of the headphones and hand it over to the next fellow, so four could listen instead of two. And that was quite a thrill.
What about car? Did you all have a car?
We had a Model T Ford.
When did you get that?
We've had, as far as I remember, we had a car.
Yeah.
But I remember riding to town with Mother in a buggy.
Yeah.
And it took about a half a day. Seemed like an awful long time to come 5 miles with an old buggy horse just plodding along.
Yeah.
And I'd get sleepy and lay down on the floor of the buggy. And get sleepy riding home always.
Yeah.
But the old Model T Ford was a very safe and successful automobile. Of course, we farmed about 150, 200 acres. And that we had to have, it was all, your power was all horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
We had lots of horses, mules. Men worked. And the work day was from 6 in the morning to 6 in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes for a dollar and a half in those early days.
Yeah.
But that dollar and a half bought something. And I remember the thrill of the first steam thrashing machine coming to thrash the wheat we raised. The steam engine had was pulling the separator. A big black thing with smoke pouring out of it. It had a wagon to haul coal. It had a water wagon. It had a cook wagon. There were 12 or 14 men that came with it. And they thrashed wheat for so much a bushel. And these poor fellows ate anything they could get. And I'm sure their cook wagon affair wasn't too good. And they slept in the straw stack at night. So they had to be a hardy bunch of individuals. And one funny thing about these thrashing machines, we were down at Uncle Will's on Cedar Creek. And Morris and I were old enough then to be some help in putting the straw back in the barn and doing things like that. And came lunchtime, and they rang the dinner bell for the men to come down to the house and eat. And Uncle Will kept and bred some jacks. Jacks are the father of mules.
Yeah.
And this old Jack was just about as curious about this steam engine as we were. So the men went to the house. Morris and I climbed up there. Just give anything to hear that whistle blow.
Okay.
So we slipped up there and got hold of that thing and gave it a big yank. About the time the old Jack came up to smell that steam engine. Well, that whistle scared him so bad he fell. Just fell right down like he was dead. And in a minute or two, that thing got up, and man of war never left there any faster than that old Jack left there. It was a common practice for taxpayers to get a credit. I think you got a credit of $4 for working on the road. And I remember working on the road between Stanford and Crabhorse. We'd take a team. And lots of people did go down, and you got an extra credit for bringing the team and haul gravel to put on the road. And I remember the merchants of Stanford, some of them would volunteer a man or two to come out and help with it.
Yeah.
And the country church was an integral part of life in those times, because it was a social gathering as well as a religious occasion. And people would quite often talk for a long time after church. It wasn't uncommon to some guy's lady to invite another family to come eat dinner with them.
Yeah.
And there are many stories about country churches and how long the services lasted and how tired little farm boys would get. Seemed like they had to have their revivals, as they called them, in July, August, about the time you were working the hardest. And frequently we would volunteer to keep the preacher and the song leader. And I remember one particular one. They were very much against smoking and drinking coffee and tea. And the first thing Mother did every morning was get that coffee pot hot and start drinking some coffee. And Father liked to smoke a pipe. And the first day they got on them for drinking that coffee and smoking that pipe, what a bad influence they were setting for these boys, and so on and so on. So they reluctantly quit. That was about the most miserable week I can recall. The time those preachers were there, because they were a little bit on the irritable side.
Yeah.
I remember another occasion, quite often in a country church, the men would stand around out in the yard and talk and visit and smoke that last cigarette until they sang a couple songs, and then they'd kind of really insist on the men coming in. There were two men out in the yard on a cattle deal. Said, now I'll give you so many dollars for so many cattle you got in that field, you have in that field there. And they were jockeying back and forth with it. And it's Farley Scott and Mr. Holsclaw and Baylor Holsclaw. And Baylor was a very nervous man that worked real hard. And a lot of the old farmers in those days carried a short pencil in their pocket. So as soon as they got inside, they asked everybody to kneel and pray. So Mr. Holsclaw was down on his knees. But he was figuring that sharp pencil on that wood floor all the time preacher was praying. So he got so engrossed in his trade, the preacher said, "Amen." Mr. Holsclaw raised up and says, "I'll take it." And quite a few little things like that went on. I never will forget a cousin of ours left home. He was about 21 or 22. His father never had been a very religious man. But he came home that summer and they were having a revival. And this poor little church didn't even have screens in the window. And he was right up close to the front, next to the window, in front of his daddy. And the preacher, he thought, looked right at him and said, "Now, Brother Gaines, we lead us in prayer." Well, his mouth stopped up and he couldn't think of a word to say. He'd never prayed in public before anyway. The only thing he'd think of is jump out the window. Just as he started to jump out the window, his father started praying. Because his father had started going to church while he'd gone away from home. And another one was a man named Joe Chancellor that joined the church at an early age, young man. And they asked him to return to pray one morning. And his mouth got dry as cotton, his tongue just froze the top of his mouth, and he couldn't think of a word to say. So he stammered, begged to be excused. So he called on another young man, about the same age, and he stumbled through a prayer. And Mr. Chancellor had a way of saying "by Joe" about everything. He said, "Well, by Joe, I could have done that good myself." My father was married once before. We have a half-sister by that marriage. Around 1900, his first wife, as old folks said, became sickly. And the doctors thought she had consumption. It was recommended then to go to a dry climate. So to save her life, my father, his first wife, and my half-sister got on a train and went to Ponca City, Oklahoma, which took several days. When he was there, they rented an apartment up over a butcher shop. I can recall my sister saying that they didn't have hamburger in those days, and they had difficulty selling the small pieces of meat. And the butcher would make soup and stews. And they could take a dime and buy a gallon bucket of good beef stew that would feed them all weekend. And Father leased some land from the Indians and raised wheat and cotton. And he'd go out in a prairie wagon on Monday and come back last of the week. And I recall one of the first times going out there, he told us about he loved quail and grouse and prairie chicken, plover. So he didn't take any meat at all. Took a shotgun. So the first night he killed enough prairie chickens for supper and for breakfast the next morning. And he warmed them up next morning. They still taste pretty good. But about the third or fourth day, you got where you couldn't eat another one of those birds. They were so rich.
Yeah.
And there's an old saying that you can't eat quail a day for 7 days.
Yeah.
And he almost proved that to himself. And these Indians were very friendly. And you remember telling about going by one of them's house, a teepee. He had a sewing machine he's very proud of, and a Winchester rifle. And he was going to go out and show my father some land he could rent from him. And father said, aren't you afraid to go off and leave this gun and this sewing machine and your possessions here? He said, no, not at all. He said, there's not another white man anywhere around here.
Yeah.
So the Indians were just as scared of us as we were. I imagine we had some bad white people.
Yeah.
They robbed the Indians, done everything else. But you were the only white man around here. We trust you.
Yeah.
So, and another occasion, he was going out to this land, and it looked like a storm. And there was an abandoned house. And he tied the horses up behind the wagon and took a blanket and went in through the blanket down on the floor on some loose straw and went to sleep. And that country was full of snakes in those times. And he felt something fall across his chest. And naturally he assumed there was a snake up there on a rafter over his head and falling down there. So he laid there what seemed like hours and days, and finally he got enough courage up to move his hand up under the blanket and throw it as far as he could and run out of the building.
Yeah.
Well, he lit a lantern and went back in there. And what had happened, there was an old halter hanging up on a rafter, and a mouse or something had gone across there and knocked it loose and fell on him. And another tale I remember him telling, there was a man named Dunn from Danville was out there, and several of them wanted to go hunting, and they took a team, a wagon, and some provisions, and went quite a few miles into some rough country, where they were bear and several kinds of wild game. And it came a rainy time, and they were just almost bogged down. And they couldn't kill anything to eat. And they tied the horses behind the wagon. And the horses ate what meal they had. And that was it.
Yeah.
They had a slab of bacon. And they hadn't killed any game, they ate the bacon up. And finally, the second day after the bacon was gone, somebody killed a wet wild turkey. And they brought that thing in and put it in a pot of water and boiled it. They got good and warm, I reckon. And they almost jerked it apart, getting a piece to eat on. And the next day, they wounded a bear. And he went into a cane thicket. And they could hear him growling. And they were afraid to go in there after him and try to get him. So the man named Dunn says, "I've had enough of this, and I'm going to get out of here." Mm-hmm. That cut off. And so he started off cross country. As I said before, it had been raining, the streams were up, and the streams out there are flatter, a lot wider than ours. And he planned to go across, and the current carried him almost a mile down from where he aimed to go. And the banks were muddy, enough to get a handhold in. And finally he washed down and he got hold of a little root and kept pulling. He got himself out on the bank. And he kind of he about half dried out. And he thought he saw smoke and smelled smoke. And he did come to an Indian house. And the Indian, he just dashed in the door. The Indian woman was cooking their meal. She was making corn cakes on a hot rock. Mm-hmm. And she'd throw her shawl down, her blanket. It's what they ate on. They squatted on that and ate. And he wasn't particularly welcome, but they let him come on in. And he grabbed the first corn cake because he was so hungry. And liked to burn his mouth. And he tried to explain to this Indian, he was trying to find a railroad to get out of there. And the railroad didn't mean anything to the Indian. And he tried to draw pictures. And finally he got the Indian's attention. Yeah, poo-poo wagon, poo-poo wagon. Said, "I take you poo-poo wagon." So they got on two Indian ponies. And they rode several miles to the railroad track. The Indian put him off. And he paid him what little money he had. Then he sat out there at the railroad track till the train came by. And he got back to Danville. The best I heard, he's never back in Oklahoma again either. Getting back to life on the farm, as I said before, we had no tractors. It took a lot of manpower. There's a little colored community across the road from our farm called Cedar Ridge. And the Stevenson family lived there. And they had worked for our family. And the Green family had worked for our family for a number of years. We had a wonderful relationship. One of the Stevensons, we referred to as Uncle Charlie. That didn't mean we were kin folks. That meant he was an elderly person and a word of respect for him. And Uncle Charlie liked to come when he got too old to work and work mother's flowers and always have a good lunch. And mother had a sister, Aunt Mabel, that a little more education, had more social advantages than the rest of us had.
Yeah.
She had been out in Missouri and come under the influence of some of Mary Baker Eddy's teaching. And she had tried to explain to all of us, and Uncle Charlie was listening, about how you just will things away and your sickness will go away and things like that. And the first peaches began to get ripe out in their peach orchard. And we had an old bull. We kept